Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth was a dark, fabulous fable that won 3 Academy Awards, put him big time on Hollywood's map. But he's also the creative mind behind superhero blockbusters like Hellboy and Blade 2. If you like his work, get ready for more. His dance card is jammed for years to come with old horror and new fantasy and thrillers and vampires. Critics are already dubbing the next 10 years the Del Toro Decade. This hour On Point, talking with fabulous director, writer, and producer Guillermo del Toro. You can join the conversation. Are you a fan? What is it about del Toro's work, his imagination, that draws you in? And are the old fables still the best stories? You may recognize some of the theme from Pan's Labyrinth there. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Guillermo del Toro joins me now in the studio, a Mexican expatriate with a long list of big projects ahead, from Kurt Vonnegut work to Disney to Frankenstein. He has a new book out, co-authored with Chuck Hogan, whose Prince of Thieves has just been made into Ben Affleck's film, The Town. Del Toro and Hogan are writing about vampires in The Fall. Guillermo del Toro, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Now, vampires are all over the place. We think of you as striking out in your own terrain, but vampires are like on every other street corner of the entertainment world lately. But you're not really in the Stephanie Meyers camp when it comes to vampires.
No.
What's your vampire?
I've been always quite a contrarian. And the reality is that at birth, the myth of the vampire is born with 2 very strong facets. The one where is the dandy, sort of the dark prince of the night, very seductive, and the other one, which comes from the classical European lore, which is the bloated, parasitic, supernatural entity. You know, and in every lore, before Polidori wrote the first English language short story, The Vampire, before that, the vampires were essentially reanimated corpses that were after your soul, after your blood. Not all of them were blood drinkers, curiously enough. They were mischievous, they were brutal, but they didn't necessarily wanted your blood all the time. And we went for the classic exception of this. We went for a brutal parasite, and we made it an epidemic. We made it really scary, really based in mundane reality. What if these things were happening now? How would the CDC really deal with it? How would the authorities deal with it? We do procedural, sort of procedural vampire
police play. Procedural style.
Yes, yes.
This is not your dashing, handsome, beautiful, swashbuckling, romantic, bare throat in beauty vampire, whether, in Victorian garb or in Stephanie Meyer's sort of a high school hottie garb. Paint a picture of your worst vampire. The Master, he's called.
Yes.
Now, this is a trilogy. This is the second. The Strain is the name of the trilogy. This is The Fall, the second book in that strain. In the first book, you might just remind us, a plane lands, an airplane comes into New York,
yes, and stops in the middle of the runway. It's essentially a dead plane. There are no lights inside. And the authorities go to investigate. They look through the window. Blinds are all drawn down. And they try to access the plane. And all of a sudden, the door opens from the inside. And they go inside the plane, and absolutely most everybody's dead. There are 4 survivors, and there is a big box full of earth in the cargo container.
A sort of a coffin.
Yes.
It is not just dirt in there.
There isn't. And, it is a very conscious reference to the ship in Dracula, the Demeter, arriving to England. And there are nods to Dracula throughout the first book, but we then take it into really nasty, quite brutal, completely modern territory.
The bodies on this plane, drained of blood, are taken away to the morgue.
Yes.
And the next day they walk away.
Some of them do.
Then the vampires are on the loose.
Yes. And we track it. What is great is you go to these guys returning to their family, because part of the lore in European myth is that the vampire starts the plague in its own household, is drawn to essentially kill the people he loves the most.
There's a conquer the world theme here. And the interesting thing is that you've got a, what, billionaire American.
Yes.
This comes in from Europe. But there's a billionaire American who is in on it, who's essentially
financing it.
He knows the whole world may be destroyed, but he himself would become...
He will live a little longer.
Immortal. A little longer. Yes. And he doesn't care. If he can live forever, the rest of the world can go.
I could name names, but I think there are, you know, I have never, ever met, maybe I haven't met enough, never met a billionaire I like.
Well, now, I mean, I don't know. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are giving half their fortunes away.
I'll call Bill and Warren tomorrow. We'll get together for lunch. I haven't met them.
But you do, I mean, you put it in terms of an epidemic, and you put it in terms of the sort of lust. The power of money and the lust for one's own over all other interests. I mean, it's not hard to take this as a metaphor for what's going on, I don't know, environmentally, what's going on economically in this country, in this world today. Do you mean that? Is that inspiring as you're getting?
Yeah, I mean, what I like very much is the opening line on the second book, on The Fall, is essentially, it took the world only 60 days to end.
And we were there to account for it, our omissions, our arrogance.
Yes.
It's easy to hear an indictment.
It is. I mean, some people were asking me yesterday in New York. They were saying, "Why did you choose New York?" I said, "Well, first of all, I think it's a society, a model, a city that is on the brink of chaos every day, and it's a miracle it doesn't. You know, but I really wanted to explore in the second and third book how easy it is to collapse what we believe is the stable world, you know?
Yes, very easy. People talking about it all the time. And how easy it is, maybe in Guillermo del Toro's world, to collapse the line between the very hard reality that we face every day and the world of fantasy. You did it very famously in Pan's Labyrinth, where you've got... a family whose farm home bodies are kind of occupied by fascist soldiers. This is in Spain in the 1940s. And you've got the little girl, Ophelia, who goes off away from that very real reality. She's underground. She's communing with quite a fabulous world. I've got a little sound from it here. It takes place in 1944. The young stepdaughter of a sadistic army officer escapes into an eerie, captivating fantasy world. In Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, here the protagonist, Ophelia, enters the labyrinth for the first time and meets a faun. Ophelia is played by Ivana Baquero and the faun by Doug Jones.
Mi nombre es Ophelia. ¿Quién eres tú?
¿Yo? Yo. Yo he tenido tantos nombres. Nombres viejos. Que solo puede
Ophelia asks, who are you? And the faun replies, me? Me? I've had so many names, old names that only the wind and the trees can pronounce. I am the mountain, the woods, and the earth. I am a faun.
Pretty good.
In Pan's Labyrinth, Guillermo del Toro directed it. It won all kinds of accolades. He's with me in the studio. He is a big figure, a big character. His great Falstaffian self with me here, and it's wonderful to have, and still smiling to hear that. Is there a line for you as you walk around the world between what's real and what's fabulous?
Yeah, I mean, I really have an incredibly fertile world inside of my head, and I claim accurately that I never get bored, never ever. I mean, my daughter, my older daughter, she's 14, and she's very much like me, you know. And I've been practicing a game with them, with my 9-year-old and my 14-year-old. Every time we're waiting for mom at the post office or the supermarket, we see people and we invent dialogue.
What could that be? What could they be saying?
What are they thinking? What are they saying? And we love it.
Where does that come from in you, in your personal history, in the culture, maybe the Mexican culture that you grew up in? Where does that come from?
Well, I was born, I was a very thin, very blonde, almost like rat lab blonde kid that used to buttoned my shirt all the way up to the neck. And
in Guadalajara.
In Guadalajara.
In a strict Catholic family.
In a strict Catholic family. And I was essentially, you know, it's almost what you normally ascribe as racism or segregation in reverse, because a kid that blonde in Mexico is like immediately targeted as
what, gringo or yeah, or in, at least upcast, outcast,
a pummeling object.
let's hit him.
And then I became very, very, very isolated, and I essentially had to invent my own games, my own universe. Eventually, tired of the pummelings, I became a fat kid, and I started fighting back. So I kind of fluffed and into being what I am right now, a size 50.
Who cares? We'll take what grew in your mind. And yes. Was it growing then? It was very early on. You were into the world of fantasy.
Yes, very, very much, because people talk about Pan's Labyrinth and they say the girl is escaping the world. And I say, no, she's not escaping it. She's deciphering it. She's understanding it through that fantasy. And there's a big difference for me, because to escape it becomes truly a way to not be in the world. And I, through the fantasy, I learned to cope and be in the world. I've never been absent. I kept observing the world. I kept processing the world. I didn't want to get away from it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with director Guillermo del Toro, the great movie fantasist, director of Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, about his work, his view of storytelling, and his side franchise, I guess you'd say, in vampires. Behind us, you hear a little theme from Lord of the Rings. He was up to do The Hobbits, put a lot of work in on it. That may not happen. We'll talk about it. But there is so much that he has done, and an unbelievable list of what he is set up to do. In the sequel to 2004's Hellboy, based on the fictional Dark Horse Comics character, the mythical world starts a rebellion against humanity so it can rule the Earth. Hellboy and his team are dispatched to save the world. Here's part of the trailer for Del Toro's 2008 movie, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
I have a suspect.
The Royal Seal.
I'm Princess Nuala. My father died to uphold the truce with your world.
I will call upon the help of all the children of the Earth. The good. The bad.
Give it up, Nasty. We can see you.
You see me? How? How do you see me?
And the worst.
And Hellboy 2 is on there. Guillermo del Toro's just one of many, many, many that he's done. So which do you like better, the comic book style or the real sort of almost, to an American eye, Euro-fabulous style of Pan's Labyrinth?
I like both. And when people ask me about moments in the movies I do that are subtle and lyrical and poetic, and others that are brutal or pulpish, I say I like both too. I mean, I like contradictions. I don't think, I think that when you are a creator, a fabulist or a storyteller, you go by instinct, like a painter would, like any other artist. And by instinct, I am drawn to, like the Gothic Romantics, to the basest and the most spiritual and elevated, both.
I've tried to keep track of everything on your upcoming dance card. I have to admit, I can't. Things come and go. Hollywood has a kind of a churn to it, and you're riding this great stream of offers that come to you. Mm-hmm. Give us the big ones. What are you planning on working on that people might be interested in the upcoming years?
It's very simple. I mean, you take it one by one. The announcements on the trades and on the internet come all at once, but or very close to each other. But that doesn't mean the movies are going to be all being worked
on. We're talking over years here. The Del Toro decade, maybe. But Slaughterhouse-Five, really? Kurt Vonnegut?
I will try. I mean, I think the...
It's been done. You want to do it again? Why?
It's not been done. It's
well,
been,
back in the 70s?
Yeah, but it's, I don't think it's the book. It's a really good movie that... I think the language and the possibilities of telling the story to have the character be unstuck in time as opposed to going flash forward and flash back. See, the book talks about time being a linear perspective that you can look back at mm-hmm. and look forward to, and it's a single continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, because of the storytelling tools, language tools that were available back then, just flash forwards and flashbacks.
Right.
And I don't think that's the book. And the book has, the thing that the movie captures is part of the humor. But I don't think all the sardonic cruelty and humor that Vonnegut had.
I didn't get it when I first read it, but then I thought about it, and there is some link between you and Vonnegut. The way he passes from these tough realities people are in into the fantasies of their minds very, very easily, like yourself.
The other day we were playing a game, and they said, who would you have for dinner from all history? And he was one of the guests I chose. He would be a great conversation to have.
Frankenstein.
I want to write it. I want to do it in a completely different way than has been done. But immediately right now, to answer your question, immediately right now we are working on pre-production actively on a movie I've been carrying with me for more than 20 years.
Yes.
I wrote with Matthew Robbins 13 years ago at the Mountains of Madness, the H.P. Lovecraft book, and it's being produced by Jim Cameron. And is a massive, gigantic, tentpole horror movie.
Now, Lovecraft is very famous, but not everybody will know. Who was Lovecraft?
H.P. Lovecraft was essentially one of the best horror writers in the history of the genre.
When was he writing?
He was writing at the turn of the century, and but he was quite a man from the 19th century, mm-hmm. mentally, spiritually, and morally. And he's a man out of time. He's a man that writes from a very prudish, very fearful point of view, and he's almost Victorian entirely in his sensibility.
And at the Mountains of Madness, what is it?
It talks about an Antarctic exploration and how a group of very square scientists essentially face a cosmic reality that puts them in perspective, saying man is essentially was created as a cosmic joke. And the entities that created everything created a city in Antarctica, and they come face to face with essentially the real ancient entities, the real dark center of the universe. But the beauty of it...
Sounds perfect for you again.
It's great for me. But the beauty of it is that we are also attempting to create creatures and environments and atmospheres that have never been done before. Antarctica, by the way, when people say to me, well, we know everything about Antarctica right now.
It's just white in a couple of mountains.
Yeah, there's a couple.
Penguins.
And the beauty of it is that it remains almost as mysterious now as it was at the turn of the century. In 2008 or 2009, an entire mountain range was discovered. Just discovered in Antarctica.
Just wait until we see what Guillermo del Toro discovers there. I can't wait. You say that Lovecraft, a great horror writer, turn of the century, a 19th century man, fearful. Compare the del Toro mind then, or worldview, or to that. Or, you know, what are you?
Well, I think as a child, I was very much a Lovecraftian little kid. But Lovecraft was writing for the pulps. He was mm-hmm. writing for weird tales, mm-hmm. and he was writing for an audience that needed thrills. So, like him, I have sort of a spiritual fear that feeds the more intangible parts of my narrative. But like him, I am also attracted to pulp, spectacle, and shock, and this and that. And he's a really interesting writer, one of the great ones, finally been inducted into the American Library. You know, he is now, I think he's a secret bestseller because he's in public domain, mm-hmm, most of his stuff. Mm-hmm. And unlike Tolkien or unlike other people, he cannot be tracked as accurately, but millions have read it.
The great director Guillermo del Toro is with me in the studio. His new book with Chuck Hogan is The Fall. We've got lots of callers for you. John in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, you're on the air with Señor del Toro.
Hola. Hi, I was just going to ask, I have two daughters, very young, 3 and 5. I draw from them inspiration, especially through my imagination. It helps me rekindle it.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering from your family membership whether that contributes to your work, and I'll take your answer off the phone.
Yes, well, listen, I couldn't have written Pan's Labyrinth until I became a father. You know, I wrote the companion piece to Pan's Labyrinth when I was younger, Devil's Backbone, mm-hmm. because it's a boy's story. It's a boy's tale. And I wrote it as a son. I wrote it as a man still coming to terms with his own childhood. Mm-hmm. But the wonder of seeing my daughter, Mariana, become such a firm, fully formed entity at a very young age make me admire. I mean, there is a mystery to childhood that, but this girl, Ophelia, was so strong. Is the strongest, most mature character in the movie, and therefore the one that I frankly needed to explain the least in the film.
You know, it's interesting, looking back, we have our childhood with its tremendous fantasy, but then, as our caller John says, and it was my experience as well, you get young children, you tell them stories all the time, and before you know it, a part of your life is again in the fantasy world.
Yes,
because
yes.
You're sharing it with them.
And early on their childhood with Mariana and Marisa,
yeah.
I used to go and tell them serialized stories.
Me too.
So every night I would say, and that will be continue tomorrow.
Yes.
No.
Yes, right,
five
exactly,
more minutes.
Exactly.
And I tell you, I must say, that those nights were as satisfying as a blockbuster opening number one.
Nothing better. I know exactly what you mean.
And I admire them. You know, unlike other parents...
Yeah.
That look at their children as things to be formed. I actually expect them to form me.
Little people to take journeys with, and what great journeys they can be. So there's At the Mountains of Madness. What else on your? Let's deal with The Hobbit while we're at it.
Sure.
Because you were in New Zealand, you were tapped to get in on this. It was Lord of the Rings was so huge. There's a lot of anticipation of this, but then MGM has all kind of financial problems. What happened to that effort? You put a lot of work into it.
Well, you know, I think that it's going to happen. I think I had many obligations that were put on hold for 2 years while I kept saying we're about to start, we're going to start in six months, we're going to start in 9 months.
You moved your family there, though.
Everybody.
New Zealand.
I mean, it's very hard to imagine that, but literally I gave up my entire life. I was going to give it up for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years passed, and it was looking more like six or seven. And if we blinked, and New Zealand is such a fantastic country.
Yes, it is.
Greatest people on earth, greatest country. And it's very easy to forget that you've already been there for 2 years.
Right.
But mercifully, there were a lot of people and legal phone calls reminding me it's been already 2 years and you haven't started. And I had to essentially take charge of my life again, and I had to take the hardest decision of my life and leave.
So if not that, you'll leap forward. What else? I mean, I'm reading about Jekyll and Hyde, frankly.
All these things, I will tackle one at a time. I will adapt them. I'm not going to adapt
them. Is there a deal or just an inspiration?
Yeah, no. Stevenson is one of my favorite writers.
Mm-hmm.
He's a writer that uses the language with such precision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like reading Lovecraft, you can argue he overwrites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were writers that were paved by the word.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right. Pulp it out.
As much as I adore Dickens, some people will argue. Well, yes, but he overwrote. I don't think so. I can read everything he wrote, but with Stevenson, like with Borges,
mm-hmm.
these guys are almost mathematicians.
Yes,
they really
hyper-realism.
They surgically insert the words, and I admire that. And Jekyll and Hyde, one aspect of it that I really want to explore is what does Jekyll get out of this? You know, it's always played either as a repressed sexual double
that
personality
that surges up against his will.
Yes, but I think, you know, I want to explore what if it wasn't.
You put it in terms of addiction. What if he likes being
Hyde? Yes, exactly right. That's what I want to explore. The addiction of being Hyde.
What if we all like being Hyde a little too much sometimes? And on Frankenstein, I mean, Mary Shelley, I've seen you say she, when she did it, you know, she said it in contemporary terms.
Yes.
Will you?
No, never. I think that nevertheless, you can make the science of the time much more exciting. And I must say, I'm knocking on wood or plywood or whatever it is. But the take I'm attempting with it is it has never been done. It's truly the one way of being faithful to the novel that fortunately for me hasn't been done. The Kenneth Branagh Frankenstein, mm-hmm. that was had a brilliant screenplay by Frank Darabont.
Mm-hmm.
When I read that screenplay, I turned to my wife and I said, well, there it goes.
All done.
I don't have to do it.
But
it really got taken through quite an unfortunate route, I may say,
mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for me, into a different direction. And, you know, look, I always say the first advantage of my Frankenstein is you will not see me chest naked on the screen.
unlike
Kenneth Branagh. Yes.
Let's take a call from Harold in Boston. Harold, you are on the air with Mr. Del Toro.
My pleasure. Bravo, bravo.
Oh, thank you.
I'm in my 70s, and in the beginning it was comic books and the movies, all of the Frankenstein and the Dracula movies. Mm-hmm. We swept over there on the Saturday afternoons. But when I saw the one that you set in Spain,
yes,
it absolutely blew my mind, where you brought together the socio-political degree of fascism that was a part of this culture. A lot of people at this generation have no idea how the Spanish people suffered there and
yes,
how it was the beginning of the Nazi rise to power by their collusion.
That's exactly accurate, yes.
Your depiction of the fascist was so impeccable. The gentlemanly murderer, the dark side of all humanity that may lurk in us.
And, I got chills Sheridan, just hearing it.
Sheridan Le Fanu, how's another writer?
I love him.
Pickman's model.
Lovecraft, absolutely. Le Fanu, Algernon Blackwood, Arthur Machen, these are great writers. Le Fanu was deemed by M.R. James to be the greatest ghost story writer ever, and I must agree. I mean, he has some of the best.
Harold, you sound like a connoisseur. Let me ask you then, when Guillermo del Toro took his Ophelia out of that very realistic, you say really captures that Spanish fascism era, when he took her, walked her into the woods and down into the world of fantasy, Pan's Labyrinth with the Faun, did you follow then as well?
Well, I fell right in love with number one special effects, because I'm a collector of antiquarian prints.
Oh.
And some of the religious images that I have collected over the years depict the horrors of the hell of the mind of humanity,
yes,
that's been infused upon our thinking. And he depicted them in perfection. And I love the Pan with the coil that almost... It has an illustration of maybe devilish, yet who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes,
how about Uncle Silas? Do you recall that?
I love Uncle Silas. I think Uncle Silas would do a fantastic miniseries. He's one of the most perverse, disquieting, ambiguous gothic tales ever. It's essentially I jokingly say, if people reading Lemon is Naked know really, I think Lemon is Naked, his narrative of comes a lot from Uncle Silas. Uncle Silas was only adapted once, twice. It was once in black and white for the BBC, and a second time on a really good movie, not great movie, but good movie with a great performance by Peter O'Toole called Dark Angel, which is very hard to get. But I think there is a chance to adapt it for a miniseries. It's a fantastic narrative by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu.
Harold, I'm so happy for your call. Thank you very much for being there. This world of fables, you combined it with Spanish fascism. It was powerful. Is it escape or is it something else in the Del Toro hands?
No, I think that there are two things I obsessed about monsters and fantasy. If you see Devil's Backbone, which is the companion piece to Pan's Labyrinth, mm-hmm, Devil's Backbone is right at the brink of the beginning of the Civil War in Spain. And if you notice this, the companion piece, Pan's Labyrinth, is supposedly after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, I love your Civil War movies.
And yet it lingers.
I never mm-hmm did a movie about the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I did about what happened before and what happened after. There are two things in particular about fantasy and monsters. Biology. I'm obsessed by biology. The Fall and the Strain are incredible.
The actual guts of the monsters.
Guts of the monsters. I explained them all. The Strain, the first book with Chuck Hogan, we answered the ever-present question of what happens to a vampire's pee-pee.
Who knows? Who knows?
You can learn it on the Strain.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with director Guillermo del Toro, the great movie fantasist, fabulous director of Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, and much more about his work, his view of storytelling. His latest book is The Fall. It is co-authored. It's Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan, who wrote Prince of Thieves, which is the book behind Ben Affleck's new movie, The Town. Here's a little bit from the trailer for The Town.
Ms. Kesey, I would like to start with your abduction.
Four men made me open the safe. They took me as a hostage.
Were you able to see anything at all through the blindfold?
No.
The Town. No relation to Guillermo del Toro, except that you are working with Chuck Hogan, who wrote the book behind that, and you're writing about vampires. Now, why are you hooked up with Chuck Hogan in this work? It's a trilogy. You've already done one. Now your second one, The Fall. Why with Chuck? What's up?
Well, I mapped out the three books before I met with Chuck on a little Bible, a little document. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, look, this is my... I had written in the past. I had short stories published in Mexico and a book on Hitchcock published in Spain and in Mexico and this and that. But I was going to tackle now a longer length fiction, and I was... I really... There's a part of American lingo and efficiency that... eludes me, you know, when they say, give me a 50 cc's of DMP.
Just a little bit too arcane.
And I first originally said, I want to read, to my literary agent, I said, I want to read every novel of anybody you like. Mm-hmm. I read like 20 novels. Mm. I didn't like any of them. And then I stumbled upon two by Chuck. One was called Blood Artists, mm-hmm. and the other one was Prince of Thieves. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away by how incredibly concrete, incredibly detailed his writing was, and it felt real. It brought, I originally described the strain as, you know, sort of The Wire with vampires, because I wanted to bring mundane reality to it. And I sent the document to Chuck, and according to Chuck, 1.5 pages into the document, he called his agent and said, I got to do this. I got to meet with this guy. And we met. Our functions became completely promiscuously intermingled as we wrote. I ended up writing a lot of the procedural stuff. He ended up writing a lot of the scary stuff. We really became fused as writing partners, and we did it. This is very remarkable. We did the first book on a handshake. We didn't have a contract.
That's terrific.
We just shook hands and
very
said,
old school.
Let's write it for free.
Wow.
Let's just do it. And we wrote it for ourselves.
Chuck, maybe in a way, because this is, as you say, very hard-boiled kind of police procedural with vampires. I mean, you've got a leading epidemiologist in here from the Center for Disease Control. You've got a Ukrainian-born pest exterminator from Brooklyn.
Yes.
And you've got one of the wealthiest men in the world. It's not just, sashes.
And a gangbanger.
Gang member and a whole lot more. And so there we understand the Chuck Hogan connection, even as his Prince of Thieves goes to the theaters in The Town. Can we talk about Mexico for a second?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people may know this story, but I was struck by it. When you got your first big movie deal, big money, very first one, you're with your family in Guadalajara, and as happens again and again and again in Mexico these days, boom, you got the deal, the money was in the papers, and you had kidnapping in your family.
My father, yes.
Your father.
Yeah, I mean, my father was kidnapped. He's a wealthy man, and how did he
make his money?
First of all, he has the fortune of winning the lottery.
Seriously?
In 1968.
No kidding?
1968, oh, $6 million, 1968.
Oh, that's a lot of money in 1968.
And he made a lot more. And he raised those blue collar. He still is the strictest boss I have ever worked for. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the brothers Weinstein, so I know what I'm talking about. And he ruled with an iron fist. And you know, he was kidnapped in 97, 98, and he was kept captive for 72 days. Mm-hmm. We went through that ordeal. I had to move because of my daughters.
Did the kidnappers know that you had the movie money, or they'd had wind of it, or just his own fortune?
That was secondary. That was collateral. But
they doubled up.
And trust me, at that point, I was not making that
much money. Yes, I understand. That's for the movie, not for your pocket.
I was still paying my debt on Cronos, my first movie. Mm-hmm, but the fact is that it's so commonplace, tragically, as you say, that Right now, I'm 2 weeks behind on my writing. And when people ask me why, I say because we had to deal with another kidnapping 3 weeks ago.
In your family?
Yeah, again. Yeah.
In extended family in Mexico?
Yes. My cousin, a friend, the night watchman and the manager of my father's car dealerships, they got kidnapped. 28 cars were taken.
28 cars. The dealership.
Yes.
Your father got out safe, and you all left Mexico in the immediate family, including his.
And these four guys got released.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You did. You got them out.
Yes, everybody got out.
Listen, I have to ask you. I mean, Mexico is a country I really like.
I love Mexico.
Mexico City, unbelievable, and many parts. But what is going on? It reads like a horror film. I mean, these mass graves in the north, people shot right and left, newspapers begging, drug lords, tell us what to write. What is going on in your country of origin?
It's essentially social decomposition. I mean, it is really not the absolute invalidation of every single social structure. It's essentially turning
just because of drugs. There's drugs in lots of countries.
Yes, but remember, I think that the fact is that the money siphons from the south through Mexico into essentially North America, and that. That center siphoning area, the fact that Mexico is the central intelligence for the distribution to the buyers, you know, and the fact that we have governments, and I mean plurally, administration after administration, that are either complicit or explicitly just inert about really doing anything. We had 70 years of one ruling party, and then when the change of power came, I haven't seen changes that have been for the positive.
But you're too unique and valuable to be to look only at the politics of this with us. I mean, those are huge, and that flow of drugs and money from the cocaine fields and so on into North America. That I know that's its own. That's kind of a hardware of this. But look at the software with this for a second.
Yes.
The Mexican. Is there, look at the side of fable. I don't even myth.
Yes.
Is there something doomy in the Mexican soul, or is this just American market for drugs?
No, without a doubt. The labyrinth of solitude, which is a great book, essentially about the Mexican soul. I think there is an incredible doom, a sense of impending death, impending doom, ingrained in our souls. By being a country, a race that was always under conquest, always under invasion, first between ourselves. I mean, we were constantly in civil war before the Spaniards showed up. And then the Spaniards brought a lot of things. You know, they gave us the gift of syphilis and,
and
smallpox and Catholic religion. I mean, many things that have now fused in a syncretism of tragedy, I think.
What's the part of Mexican myth and fable and heart that can push back against this? Is there a bottom to this? Is there a place where this will stop and turn the other way?
I think that that's why I keep, in my movies, I keep talking about mundane horror being far more, is hard to grasp than fantasy horror, because the fusion, the absolutely unimaginable fusion of drug dealing and politics, completely enmeshed, inextricably enmeshed. It's possible it originated in countries that were a quarter or a tenth of the size of ours.
Yes.
But the fact that a country the size of ours has now been essentially overtaken, and every major institution, and I mean all of them, I don't want to irate anyone, but they are co-opted by the drug money. It does make a difference. Now, I am entirely with the Greeks about that philosophy that we don't need great government if we have great citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But when your exercise of citizenship comes often with being thrown at the doorstep of a police station without your head, it requires bigger movements. And I really think that we are at a crossroads. I don't think we are at a dead end, but I am at a loss right now, and especially after what has happened in the last 4 weeks in my personal life, I don't feel completely objective or qualified to to have an opinion.
Can we set that aside for a second? I'm glad to have your thoughts on it. Catholicism in your work.
Yes.
What's the...
Well, you know, I was a very Catholic boy. I was as a kid, I was an official spokesperson for the Virgin Mary, which was quite a charge.
That's big.
I was a very devout Catholic, mostly, I must admit, out of fear.
Fear of?
Fear of...
God, Father,
Paul. Original sin and every sin after that. Yeah. You know, and hell and purgatory and all of the above. But as years go by, I always say I was born age 70. And I am the ugly version of Benjamin Button. I'll never look like Brad Pitt. But as I grow older, I get younger. Right now, I am finally living the life of a kid. I have great friends. If I want to meet a character and go to a place that doesn't exist, we build it. You know,
so does Catholicism inform your work, or does your work escape Catholicism?
Oh, no.
Or it's all together?
Look, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. Mm-hmm. You never escape it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, for example, in Catholicism, there is a principle that is redemption through pain.
Yes.
And suffering. Mm-hmm. Now, if I have, an agnostic thinker, I really say, well, I may not be able to figure out everything, but I have figured out that the fact is pain is a threshold that you always have to cross. Sometimes the right decisions are the tough decisions, the ones that look the least appetizing or least inviting.
Mm-hmm.
And I have created sort of my own philosophy of how to live, and it boils down to trying to be as good a man as I can. In my daily life, with my wife, with my daughters, with everybody I meet.
But is that redemption through pain? Why not through truth or through joy?
I think that pain and joy, both. And that's why I'm saying I kind of moved past the Catholic just suffering. I keep telling my daughters, if you find anything difficult, face it and vanquish it. Because every time you avoid a painful situation,
mm-hmm.
life sends you one twice the size mm-hmm. a couple of years later. And if you avoid that one, twice the size next.
I've been keeping our listeners waiting, and I'm sorry. Williamsburg, Virginia, Alan. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I'd like to see your guest do Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, which is a book about a man who wakes up finding himself turning into an insect, a huge insect.
Yes.
I would love that. I would love to set that against the background of politics.
Yes, he's right.
No, but I agree. It's an incredibly compelling book and a seminal work in, I would say, fantasy, because...
Of course.
Kafka was a fantasist.
Yes.
A very dark one. I love insects. I'm obsessed by insects. And they figure prominently in many of my movies, not the least in Mimic, mm-hmm. which is essentially the reverse of Metamorphosis.
It's
insects that are willing themselves into being men. And the original ending of Mimic, curiously enough, mm-hmm. The first time I took a meeting with at Miramax, mm-hmm. I said to Bob Weinstein, I said, these are my three rules for Mimic. No explosions, no guns, no happy ending. And the movie that I ended up doing had explosions, guns, and the happy ending.
Oh, boy. Okay.
But
redemption through pain.
My original ending was the final mimic reforms in the tracks of the abandoned subway, and his silhouette is exactly that of a man. And he approaches the character played by Mira Sorvino, and he gently touches her lips with one finger and says, "Leave." He speaks. And that was, for me, the ultimate horror, that they finally mm-hmm. mastered consciousness and the power to speak. But instead of that, there is a big explosion now.
Robert in Lexington, Kentucky. Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. And I just want to say that Pan's Labyrinth might possibly be my favorite movie of all time because it left me bawling with tears, the hope of the child that you express. And the real competitor for that title in my personal life is Children of Men,
yes.
Because it left me with the same feeling,
the
hope of children in our world. And I'm wondering if you could just talk briefly about the relationship between those two movies, because I understand there was some collaboration,
mm-hmm.
as well as the greater theme about how we can see hope in the world through the child's eyes. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
I think that everything that is wrong with the world, if we were going to the root, starts with the way we raise our children. that's exactly the root of everything. I think family is the ultimate central nucleus.
And what's wrong in a nutshell? We've got a minute and a half. Everyone's on the edge of their chair now.
I think the fact that, you know, there was a philosopher, an inventor, brilliant guy called Pike, that said we should treat children like ambassadors from a far wiser civilization from which we need to learn. And Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth are both sort of altars to the fact that the most admirable spirits we have around are children. They are fantastically strong. In the case of Ophelia, mysterious, full of grace. I always say that I believe every girl is a princess. Every girl is born a princess. And if it's hard to be a woman in the modern world, it's much harder to be a girl. And if it's hard to be a man in the modern world, it's much harder to be a boy. And we don't give them credit for that. We don't give them the chance at complexity. And childhood is an incredibly complex time. Mm-hmm. The more we... I always say, you know, when Pan's Labyrinth had some violent moments and people called me on that and I kept talking to the MPAA, I wanted it to be PG-13, it was an R. Mm-hmm. I said, I find it much more immoral to make an escapist movie where a kid skateboards away from a monster and just is a wisecracking little guy than a movie where you have the pain.
They go into the den of the monster, above ground in life and below in fantasy.
Yes.
That may be part of that gift of children you describe right
there. Indeed.
Ambassadors from a wiser civilization. We're very happy that that spirit stays so vividly alive in you. Guillermo del Toro is with us, the great director of Pan's Labyrinth, The Devil's Backbone, and Mimic, and so on. Hellboy 2, Blade 2. His new book with Chuck Hogan is The Fall. Guillermo del Toro, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.